already done the intro. All right. So, what is your age?
62.
And then, what is your ethnic identification?
White, European, if you.
What is your gender?
Male. Male.
Yeah, sorry, yeah. There's a no. Yeah. Once again, the ears. What is your formal education and your profession?
Law degree, lawyer, and nonprofit manager.
Good. And what prior jobs did you have before coming to EPA?
Thank you. Before coming to EPA,
yeah.
I was at a law firm, and before that, on Capitol Hill, and you know, started as a legislative aide, and then worked for basically the same thing, congressional caucus. That.
All right. And when you got to the EPA in 1990, if I recall correctly, what part of the agency did you first work?
Office of Policy, Planning, and Evaluation, which no longer exists.
And what other positions during your time in the agency did you have?
I worked in the Office of the Administrator as a Special Assistant. I ran in that office a pollution prevention staff, you know, half a dozen people. And in 1994, was actually late 93, early 94, assigned to an enforcement office, which had just been reformed and, you know, consolidated and reformed and made larger.
And the enforcement office is underneath the OGC, correct?
No.
Oh, it's not?
No, that's a not logical assumption, but thank you.
Thank you.
The enforcement office enforces the federal environmental requirements. The Office of General Counsel advises the agency about the legal validity of regulations and standards.
Okay.
And that, if the agency is taken to court, as often happens, OGC is part of the group that will defend the rule. Usually the Justice Department will do the argument, but the General Counsel's office will be very involved in writing the briefs and participating in legal strategy.
Okay. All right. So only in litigious affairs does it get involved. Got it.
Correct.
All right. All right. So I wanted to quickly, and the last question is, why you left EPA, but you kind of wrote a big thing on that in your resignation letter. Is there anything you'd like to add that's not already a public document?
I don't think so. I think you basically have it.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm just going to quickly tell you the main structure for how this interview is going to work. You went through three different administrations.
I did.
You know, Bush 1, Clinton, and Bush 2. What I'm going to do is I wanted to go through those three transitions with questions for them, and so we'll go first Bush, the questions, then Clinton questions, then Bush 2 questions. And then final kind of quick questions at the end, kind of summary questions. All right, so during Bush 1, what was your position and location in the agency?
I started out in the Office of Policy, Planning, and Evaluation. I'll just call the Policy Office. Mm-hmm. That's what it was. They were charged with reviewing new standards and thinking about picking up sort of innovative ways to get regulations to be more cost-effective. Mm-hmm. I was there, I might have been there 15 months, and then I was brought up to the Administrator's Office as a Special Assistant. Toward the end of that time, ran a small pollution prevention staff.
What were your tasks or responsibilities with the pollution prevention?
My portfolio was pollution prevention, which was a hot idea at the time, and was focused on ways the agency could reduce pollution at the source rather than focus more on treatment and control systems, which you're always going to have, but the idea was, what can you do in terms of encouraging recycling, encouraging cleaner production processes that generate less waste that has to be managed, design chemicals, so they're more...
Sorry, design what?
Chemicals, so they're have less impact on the environment.
Okay. So, it seems like it was a very broad sense of pollution. That there wasn't exactly a specific industry that you targeted?
Yeah. I was involved on the Hill in my last days there in getting the Pollution Prevention Act, you know, drafting that and getting it through Congress. And that set broad objectives to, you know, maximize pollution prevention. Also set up a small grant program. So that's kind of what I came in the agency to do. Those programs were basically voluntary. And they included, for example, an initiative to try to encourage companies to reduce their releases of highly toxic chemicals.
Okay.
And which was fairly successful. Although a lot of the reductions made through that program were also required under federal law. Say, for example, the Clean Air Act. But we thought the combination of having baseline requirements and a program that encouraged people to stretch and, you know, target these chemicals for reductions would be a good thing. You know?
Mm-hmm. And to kind of push that type of regulation through, did you find that your supervisors were helpful
yes.
in assisting you with that?
Yeah. Okay. I found there was a lot of turf jockeying in the agency that was, because pollution prevention cut across programs, it was not a kind of established mainline office within EPA, which, and they have their own power structure. Mm-hmm. I was struck how challenging it was to work across those lines and also to work with regions which have an independent management structure. They answer to headquarters,
yeah.
but the regional administrators were politically appointed,
yeah.
and that created a lot of sort of internal governance issues.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that kind of goes into my next question is, how specifically for you, then, would you say that politics affected your work during that period?
How did which folks?
How did politics affect your work during that
period? Well, quite a bit. The Hill was interested in pollution prevention for mixed reasons. There was an attempt successfully to move the Pollution Prevention Office out of what was then the Policy Office and into the Office of Toxic Substances. That then became the Office of Pollution Prevention and Toxic Substances.
Mm-hmm.
Why did that happen? Partly it happened because there was concern over the management of pollution prevention activities within the policy office.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, some anxiety about that within EPA and also outside the agency. Thank you. That's great.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks. Yes, thanks.
Yeah, definitely.
So, you are in a position to judge being from New Orleans.
Yeah, I know, right? That's
right. I mean, you're going to rule on this.
I was thinking it's kind of a bad idea to order something that your city's famous for. But,
yeah, really.
But it looks good, honestly.
It does look pretty good.
You know, I will say, though, that I mean, the key to a good... this is all getting recorded. But the key to a really good po' boy is actually having the bread be a little stale. And just,
really?
Yeah, you don't want fresh bread for it. You need, like, a crispiness that kind of comes apart as you eat it. But
that's... I'll make note of that. So, when the program was moved,
it's good though.
from the policy office to the Office of Toxic Substances. I was planning to go with it, and I was over there for a little while. But then Senator Mikulski's staff wrote in on an appropriations bill, a requirement that a staff with at least five people be housed in the administrator's office. They didn't want the program to be what they consider to be buried within another program.
Okay.
So I went back to the administrator's office to try to manage that.
Did you, during that period, did you feel like you made any enemies?
In that phase? You're talking now about all of EPA, or?
No, I'm talking about, you know, you specifically in terms of what you wanted to regulate, that, you know, people started kind of noticing you and targeting you.
Well, I was involved in initially in programs that were new and, you know, required some interruption in the work of program officers. So they had to do things a little differently. That created anxiety. An example of something we did when I moved back to the administrator's office is we put out a memo that said that the grants that EPA gave to state agencies should be administered flexibly to give the state agencies room to move funds around to deal with the most significant problems. That was popular with most with the heads of state agencies, much less popular with their program offices, who were used to counting on revenue, and with EPA program offices. And honestly, in retrospect, it was really good. Thanks. I'm not sure it was a great idea. I understood better after I'd been at EPA, you know, why you need water grants to support water work, you know, and because it's, as it is, the agencies can barely keep up with it.
Right.
So it's an example of disruption that, you know, may mean one thing in Silicon Valley, but in government can be creative, but also comes with a price, and I'm not sure I would have done the same thing. And then I was involved in reorganizing the enforcement program because they had to decide what the structure was going to be. And the structure that I basically recommended, and it was very much a committee process. I persuaded the committee to endorse it. Broke up some of the traditional media-by-media lines. Pollution prevention thinking was, you know, we have too many stovepipes, we need to think more broadly. Mm-hmm. I thought that enforcement should be organized by industry sector so that you look at multiple problems at the same time. And that's how the enforcement office was, partly how it was set up. So the actual enforcement arm had an air and a water division. The Office of Compliance, which did the targeting and the planning and the monitoring, that was organized more by industry sector. That's since evolved.
Yep.
That structure wasn't, in the end, sustainable. And I think partly that was internal. Leadership wasn't quite there to follow through on it. I was the deputy in that office. But I didn't stay very long, and, you know, so I could be been part of the problem. There wasn't the internal management to see it through, and I also think it had some conceptual problems because it was actually difficult to do what looked good on paper, harder to do in reality. That said, the idea of working on enforcement issues by industry sector that took hold, and that is the way that enforcement organizes and manages work. So they do it from what, so for example, for the hazardous waste program, the mineral processing industry is the target because it's generating huge volumes of waste that create serious environmental issues when things go bad. And they're often big violations. But by sticking with the industry, you get to learn a lot about the industry, and it's better for negotiating, it's better for enforcement. So some of the concepts survive, even if the flowchart, you know, has since been amended some. So you said enemies. I had adversaries who were people who, like when they saw me coming, it was a little bit of an angel of death thing because I was like a reorganization guy. Mm-hmm. And I felt that tension for sure. I was then made director of the Office of Enforcement in my last 5 years. I didn't have any direct enforcement experience. I think the people in the headquarters, some of them, not all of them, some of them resented it. And in retrospect, you know, there's several of them that I just needed to move. And, you know, didn't quite have the confidence to do that. I was much more popular in the regions because I felt like, and I still feel like, the enforcement office at headquarters had become this kind of, you know, they had an oversight function, but the oversight function always came at the end of a process where the region had negotiated a settlement or was about to bring a case, and headquarters staff were scrolling over documents and raising concerns late in the game, and sometimes not always, you know, the most important thing. So I was actually the regional, if you want to think of internal politics at EPA, the regional councils, who are the regional lawyers, their offices generally were enthusiastic about my being put in to the job. Some people at headquarters were anxious.
Yeah.
So
can you describe a little bit more about that anxiety and what you think created that anxiety for them?
Yeah, I think part of the issue is because I came from the Office of Compliance. I had worked on what I think was a pretty successful audit policy, which was designed to give people an incentive, if they audited and found violations, to disclose them, offering a reduced penalty or no penalty if there was no kind of a no harm, no foul. And that was done because the agency was facing the threat of hostile legislation from the Newt Gingrich Congress that would have been much more sweeping and I think done some damage. I think regional council especially really supported the policy. Some people at headquarters were anxious about it. When I came over to enforcement, I think there were some people that thought, well, he's just going to be about voluntary compliance and we're an enforcement shop. And I think that, for the most part, went away. Because we had a pretty aggressive enforcement program and we brought some pretty big cases. And I was right in the middle, and I'm very supportive of those. In fact, I was pushing some of the critics, some of the people who were most anxious about my not being an enforcement guy, basically saying, where are your cases? Where's your output? It's not just a talking theory here. It's an enforcement program.
Right.
So one of the ways it's manifest, if you have that problem, is there's a distortion of message. There's a kind of foot dragging that can happen on initiatives. And there's a slowness to do what I thought would result in bigger cases. And that was true in the water program. Not true in air or the other divisions that I managed.
Okay, so what I'm getting at, and I want you to correct me if this isn't correct, that the water program was reluctant for...
When I say the program, this is the enforcement program in my office. Right.
So perhaps the lawyers in the water program were reluctant to run up against, or the policymakers?
Yeah, the lawyers were. They thought they had a system down.
Yeah.
Honestly, I think they were threatened by the notion that they might do some actual casework, because they were more in a kind of oversight, take the documents that came from the regions and ride herd on those. And some of that needs to be done, but regions didn't like that very much. And I wanted national cases because we were fighting states that, were really going after EPA in somewhat like they're doing now. Now it's much more extreme, but there's some of that. And I thought, look, if we're attacking, maybe attacking is the wrong word, but if we're going after pipelines and facilities that, companies that have 20 facilities across the country, it's both, we get bigger bang for the buck, and it's easy to argue this is a national initiative that's multi-state. We're not going into just one state and picking one company. We can tell the states, we're looking at this industry across the board. And we could make states understand that for the most part. Once they got that, they felt less, anxious about their turf. Okay. So, and I couldn't get the staff in the water program to really understand that. I also, frankly, I couldn't understand why some regions didn't produce water cases, and I was more concerned about the lack of enforcement than about the very last steps of reviewing a consent decree for its adequacy.
All right. So it wasn't exactly a political reason why they didn't want to get into it.
They're not in the sense of... political in the sense that they started out thinking I was soft on enforcement. I had these very young people come in my office and try to lecture me on deterrence. I understand what deterrence is. And I met with when I took the job, I said I'd meet with everyone in the 150 people. I said, everybody gets one-on-one. My first 3 months, I'm going to open the calendar. You want to come in? And about 80 people did. And it was actually very useful. I learned a lot. And that helped. But I found people kind of rigid without quite enough thought.
So bureaucratic, or?
Yeah, to be honest, that's what I thought. I had come from the Hill, I'd worked in industry, I'd worked for a nonprofit, I bounced around. I was dealing with people who had been in EPA 20 years and hadn't known anything else, and I mean, I can see the initial concern that, hey, putting somebody in the office who hasn't actually been in an enforcement program, mostly been doing voluntary stuff, but should have been pretty clear in, after. And I think it was to most of the people in the office that, no, I'm like gung-ho for enforcement. I want bigger cases. I don't want just a, small bag of small stuff.
Right. This may not be relevant to what you're actually working on, but when you're working those initial cases, did you find actual pushback on the science that you're using to back your cases up?
From who?
From, let's say, from states, from not wanting to comply with certain regulation.
A lot of enforcement cases are, there can be fights about the monitoring data, about interpreting data. example is we took off after coal plants for having that had been modified to increase their output. And that, as a result, significantly increased emissions, but had never gotten a permit or control those emissions. Those are the so-called grandfathered plants, without getting into details, but you know, they're the ones that don't have to meet the rules in a new plant.
Right.
Has to meet the stricter rules. So they're allowed to let slide, but if they try to get bigger, you know, if they're physically expanded or modified in a way that jacks up their output and their emissions, grandfather is over.
Got
they have
it.
To come in and pay the, you know, pay the freight. They have to put on a scrubber, for example. So we'd always get in fights with the industry about it. So one of the things we had to show, I'm sorry to back up, was there a modification? And the fights we had there were a mix of law and fact. So the law part is, well, is this a, quote, routine repair? Because that's an exemption.
Okay.
Or is it a actual physical modification that is not routine and pushed emissions up? So an example is the industry would say, well, it's routine because everyone does it. And we had a judge, and I remember, I thought it was a great line, she said in one of the hearings, a whole lot of people have heart surgery in the U.S. Does that make it a routine operation? And that's how we thought.
Right.
They might argue over the records. Usually the emissions were fairly straightforward for the cases we got, but it can get very complicated. You have some plants, for example, that because of the way the permits are written, rarely actually test their emissions. So you're having to basically model what the emissions are based on throughput factors, and then so you can fight over that. There's always fights over evidence and enforcement.
Yeah. A quick kind of long-term career question. Did you notice during your entire time at the EPA, when you would have those HIPAA cases, did the language being used or what was permittable as fact, did you notice it changing or shifting? That was, you know, you'd think, oh, 5 years ago that wouldn't be considered.
EPA shifts all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I think the agency, we can enforce a rule that's no longer in effect. You also almost never enforce a brand new rule. There's usually a kind of shakeout period.
Yeah.
And I can't say we never did, but the rules we were enforcing, like the grandfathering rule, that had been on the books forever. EPA had kind of created over time a series of exceptions and clarifications, and, you know, we used to call it, some of those were in the rule book, some of them were interpretive decisions.
Yeah.
At one point, there was a program called Shadow Law.
Thank you.
That was created outside the agency, Shadow Law, and it was to take all the plant-by-plant decisions or the guidance documents and try to put them in order, because people can come into court using them, saying, wait a minute, you said over here that I could do this. Region 4 said I could do it.
Yeah.
So to deal with that, we put out probably 25 compliance alerts, what we call them, and we would say, I'll just pick a wonky example. The rules say if you run a combustion device, you have to meet a sulfur limit. A flare is a combustion device. A combustion device doesn't just mean a heater that's designed to actually drive heat to a process. It includes a flame that we're using to burn off waste gas. We thought that was pretty freaking obvious, but I remember a case, Roman Haas is the name of the case, where there was a fair notice problem. The industry said, I'm shocked, I didn't know you expected me to do this. And by the way, Region 7 said I didn't, so we created the compliance alerts as a way to kind of stay ahead of the game. I'm not quite sure that answers your question, but a lot of the...
it's helpful because...
I know the feeling.
The question was originally posed for a scientist, so I was just trying to modify it for a legal aspect. So it's answered the way
so
that...
So scientists, the rules are heavily, heavily fought over in terms of the science behind them. I mean, I'm talking about, cubic yards of testimony, scientific data, cost benefit, and so that's fought when you set rules. You have loss of it when there's an enforcement action, but you're often wrangling over the evidence.
Okay.
Okay. So, but you asked then about rules changing, and I would say it's less the changing rules than keeping up with the interpretations.
Okay.
Like, making sure that the agency's been reasonably consistent, because to the extent you're not, and that's going to bite you, and it should.
Mm-hmm. All right, so let's move into the transition into Clinton. What position, when the transition first happened, were you holding? I guess early 93.
Well, so in 93, I was in the administrator's office running the pollution prevention staff. And I've been in the administrator's office about 2 years.
Right.
I was not, at least I don't remember, being on a transition team. Usually a transition team would be people inside and outside the agency, and I wouldn't have expected to be, but I was tapped because they needed somebody in what turned into Carol Browner's staff to represent the administrator and on the enforcement of the organization, and basically to help coordinate.
Yeah.
I was one of about 10 people working on that.
And did you notice kind of a cultural shift in terms of attitude, mood, tension?
I would say people were glad to see Branner and Clinton come in, but it was not a rough transition. Bill Riley had been the administrator. I think the reason people felt good about the transition was not EPA, not change in EPA management. The management under Bush 1 was pretty popular. I think pretty effective. Some of the best managers that I saw. I'm talking now about the political appointees. I was not one.
Right.
I think the concern was the White House, and the White House had a hardcore of pretty conservative activists working in Dan Quayle's competitiveness council, who were gunning for EPA and trying to get in EPA's way. And you could argue that was their function, but EPA saw, I think, that changeover as, we'll get rid of those guys.
Yeah.
And that happened, obviously. And then, of course, in 94, the Gingrich Congress came in and the heat was back on. But there was not a lot of tension between the political people leaving and the political people coming in that I remember.
So most of your supervisors, especially if you were in the office administration, your supervisors, what would you say the relationship, were they still kind of helping you out during that period? Were they more or less supportive during...
See, I was in a weird situation for that period. My supervisor was Nancy Firestone, who was the deputy... Hank Habeck, who was the deputy administrator, and Nancy Firestone was his assistant deputy administrator. They were great. They were pretty much the only people I was accountable to.
Okay.
I didn't have a complicated web of reporting relationships. That is one of the benefits of being in that kind of special assistant mode.
Okay. All right, so I really want to get into the Gingrich, Newt Gingrich Congress, where what type of tactics did he use and his people use to kind of go after...
Well, they, you know, as he has done his whole political career, he likes to challenge the legitimacy of government functions that he doesn't like or his backers don't like. So they wanted to make enforcement about, and Tom DeLay was also high in the ranks and a former pesticide formulator from Texas and was very, he was generally angry about everything as far as I could tell, kind of like the Tea Party people.
Right.
So they wanted to make EPA the kind of mean, you know, the jackbooted thug and so on. And I had to go out to a lot of industry groups and represent EPA at the time, along with other people in the office, and I kept what I told, what, you know, a true story, which was in the last year, actually in the year before the Gingrich Congress came in, Dingell's staff had called us up, John Dingell, who was always very strong on enforcement, whatever positions he took on regulation of cars and trucks, he was very big on whatever law Congress wrote, we gave that to you to enforce, and we need to enforce it. So when we were under pressure to relax enforcement, and this was around the fight over what are we going to do about audits, they basically said, don't you dare, and, you know, kind of read us the Riot Act, don't go soft on us.
Yeah.
So 6 months later, we're being taken up to the hill, and the issue is, you jackbooted. So I would, to the industry audience, I would say, look, we're the same people. Like, they both can't be right. It can't be that we were weenies in October, and in March, we're, you know, kicking down people's doors. Come on, let's get real. And so, and we got a little, the industry guys who were savvy, you know, they, some of them are pretty sensible, they would recognize that and chuckle. We knew for Gingrich, though, it was an existential threat to the enforcement program. We faced an existential threat. We could not just do the same things we were doing and be completely defensive, curl up in a ball and be defensive.
Right.
So that's why we took something like the audit policy and we said, let's get ahead of the game. There is an argument for treating people who voluntarily disclose violations and are willing to correct them differently than you treat somebody that you have to catch.
Right.
Right? That's logical. And we can work our way through it, and we did. And I think that took a lot of thunder away from them.
Yeah.
We've set up compliance assistance centers. I was in the office of compliance at the time and said, look, we're going to have an online place where if you're a metal finisher, you can go for counsel on how to comply. And we gave a grant to the metal finishers to help to run it. They did things like, you could have things like a 3D simulations, you know, of metal finishing of different stages in the process that people could follow. We published compliance notebooks for key, like 19 of them for key industry sectors. They turned out to be like translated into Serbian, and I mean, they were very popular.
So, did it work? Did the effects work?
Yeah, it did. I like to think that we came out of it stronger, because it was such a threat. We had to step back and say, well, what's first of all, where is there a reasonable concern that we've been too stiff and rigid, and that we need to, you know, for example, voluntary compliance. What are we going to do about that? What statement can we make? What support can we give? On the enforcement side, it kind of drove us toward, we wanted to do anyway, toward big targets. It's like, they can attack us for bringing an enforcement case against a large power company, and they did. Some of them did. But it's going to be hard for them to get public traction. This is a huge coal plant with a, you know, black smoke pouring out of it.
Right.
And if there's a place to be, it's working on that. And there were lots of those opportunities. So we ended up kind of giving on the voluntary compliance side, trying to make that easier. And on the enforcement side, going after bigger game. And I think it made our program better. We also, if you read the enforcement, go online and look at the enforcement cases, the way they're described. It's actually very lucid. They walk you through what was the case about, what was the environmental benefit, how much did you take out of the environment. And that was, we started to quantify that. So instead of a press release that said, we got a $2 million penalty, we'd say, we got 50,000 tons of nitrogen oxide out of the air and a $2 million penalty. And that kind of put enforcement on the map in a different way.
So when you said going after kind of bigger fish, not your exact words, were you referring to petroleum refineries? The petroleum
refineries
industries?
Were one example. We had, I mentioned mineral processors, coal plants, certainly. Yeah. Municipal sewage systems, which were always bread and butter for EPA because they're constantly having issues.
Yeah.
But those were a target.
Mm-hmm. And when you started going after bigger fish, did you notice anything in terms of...
Yes, very good.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you
so much.
Want to
check out a dessert menu today?
Okay.
And a coffee for you?
I'm full. He wants coffee.
Yeah, I think I might be... actually, yeah, I do want a coffee. Coffee would be great. Thank you.
Cream and sugar?
Cream.
And you don't want a top off?
I think I'm all right. Thank you.
Did you notice any pushback with that industry? I mean, people must have noticed that you started going after, so...
We had an interesting sort of dynamic. We, yes, that was a big pushback. I mean, they don't want to spend all that money.
Right.
But for refineries, we had a different, somewhat different approach. And I was most heavily personally involved in that, where we would write to the companies ahead of time. Oh, well, first we got everyone together from the regions at several meetings, and we basically said, what are the chronic problems at refineries that you run into over and over that need to get fixed and have the most impact on the environment? We came up with five, you know, a list of five targets. I took those targets to, I must have gone to 15 industry meetings, lay them out in a PowerPoint and say, look, this is what we see. We're telling you now. Look, we're showing you. You can see my hands. See my hands? I'm waving them around. Not a sneak attack. You know, got questions about it. Give us a call. You know, but this is what we see. I think they appreciated that. They really do. Even though they were kind of treating them like, not like, you know, criminals or suspects, but like business people. Mm-hmm. Who said, I know you got a business to run. We have a business to run. Yeah. You know, it's called compliance. We're not seeing it in these areas. I think in some cases you can actually, some things cost money, other things are going to be actually cost savings.
Thank you.
Either way, it's got to get addressed. We then sent letters to companies and said, here are the issues. I sent certified mail to all of them, so there wasn't going to be a question about that. Well, I don't know. And then we did some inspections and investigations. We began a series of negotiations, and we said, we want corporate-wide settlements. We want all your refineries, not just one. And that worked pretty well. Okay, I'm not saying it would work, but I think it worked remarkably well. Harder with power plants, a tougher, more obdurate industry. Some of them, you know, regulated by utility commissions with their own sort of networks. There we were more aggressive in the first instance. We just dropped the complaints on them and said, and we talked constantly to the lawyers and to industry at conferences also, but we came out of the gate with complaints.
Yeah.
Which immediately puts them on the radar and means you're fighting a war in the press and on the Hill.
But you didn't notice no dirty tactics or anything like that.
Oh, yeah. Well, it depends on what's dirty.
Well, I suppose people following you, bugging you.
No, I didn't see that.
Okay. So, all right. So we've already gotten 45 minutes. I kind of want to get into Bush 2 at this moment, unless you have anything to
hear. Okay.
So, the big transition, Bush 2, were you still in the same position that you were?
Yes, in that I took the job of director of the Office of Civil Enforcement in March or April of 97.
Okay.
And so in 01, like January or February, I was still on the job.
Okay.
And didn't leave it until March of 02.
Okay. And what were your main responsibilities in that role?
During transition?
No. When you took the office in 97.
What I've been talking about. I mean, that's the Office of Civil Enforcement.
Okay, that was,
the office that in headquarters drives the civil enforcement agenda.
Got it.
For the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, and hazardous waste law.
Okay. Apologies. I got confused on the timeline.
That's okay.
Okay. So when the transition actually happened, did you notice the transition team or you weren't a part
it
of
was,
it?
It was more hostile.
Yeah.
There have been a lot of industry complaints about us, and the line of attack was, as it is today, it was, they're operating unlawfully, they're going beyond what the law requires, they don't have any authority, and our attitude was, you know, that's for courtroom. Of course you'll say that. It had traction within the Bush administration, especially among people who came in with Cheney. So, the shadows were lengthening. That was a different feeling than when Bush 1 turned into Clinton.
Did a lot of your fellow colleagues leave during that period?
No, I don't think so. I don't recall that. I know some people were who close to retirement left, but the heat was on enforcement in particular.
Okay.
And no, I didn't see an exodus from the enforcement program.
And so you only have one exact supervisor in your position.
Well, no. It's a little more complicated, but usually two. So I was the office director for the civil enforcement program. There were a number of offices inside the enforcement tent. My old, office of compliance, which is also still there.
Yeah.
Above that network of offices was the assistant administrator. Who's a political appointee, and his principal deputy, who was not a political appointee, came up from the ranks. So
okay.
I really had those two as supervisors. A lot of day-to-day, depending on the issue, I would deal with either the deputy or the assistant administrator.
Okay.
The deputy was excellent, as was the AA. They gave me total support. I never had a minute of problems.
The assistant administrator, you had a good relationship.
With the Clinton assistant.
Oh, assistant, yeah. But once it transitioned...
For the first few months, it was mostly run by the deputy administrator. They brought a fellow in, had nominated a fellow from Ohio. He ended up getting shot down. And I'm trying to remember if he withdrew. I think he may have withdrawn, but the environmentalists mobilized to oppose his nomination. Based on some things he had done in Ohio, they didn't like. I didn't have a personal problem with him. He was an amiable guy, and I didn't feel like he was breathing down my neck. I did feel, though, that the program offices were anxious about what we were doing, and particularly the assistant administrator for AIR was hovering and wanting to, and did, get in the way of some of what we were trying to do.
Okay. So what exactly did...
So I don't know if you want this, but there's internal tension between enforcement and program office. So when enforcement consolidated and was its own program, we would be cracking down on people that, meanwhile, the program office maybe was negotiating with on a rulemaking or... was just trying to keep happy because they were, you know, didn't want Congress calling them up for hearings and they wanted to get a regulation through the White House.
Yeah.
So there was definitely some resentment with the program offices under Clinton, thinking that, you know, we were the kind of the bad news bears and we were there to kind of cast a, you know, turn things into a rainy day. And we were about finding problems.
Yeah.
Programs didn't always, frankly, want to know. There was that tension to begin with, and then with the Cheney Bush crowd, they were clearly like going to try to do something about our enforcement against the energy industry.
Yeah. So you mentioned the
assistant administrator.
Assistant air. So what type of tactics did you?
Well, so we had cases developing against big animal feedlot operations. We thought they were the biggest of them. And I'm talking about, you know, a million birds in an egg layer operation.
Yeah.
In, you know, big clusters of barns. We thought they were significant air pollution sources.
And for
no, actually for particulates sometimes for hydrogen sulfide.
Okay.
Particulates from poultry operations, hydrogen sulfide from hogs. We had negotiated one settlement and we're on our way to negotiating another. We had run the traps, we'd gone to the Department of Agriculture, we'd briefed them and made them understand this is about, these are very big agribusiness operations. This is not grandpa's, you know, chicken house. This is like, we're talking. The hog operation is really unbelievable. It's like hundreds of thousands of hogs. And the people around those facilities were very unhappy with their air quality. So we were actually responding to complaint. And there were other farmers. Like they said, it stinks like you can't even go out of the house.
Right.
So responding to complaint, and the assistant administrator for the air program basically said, don't do that. You have to stop. And I thought, wait a minute, we can't. Can you tell us to stop? And I wrote a memo about it. I brought a memo to a meeting where I thought we were going to. I brought basically a slideshow to try to show what the problem was. We didn't even get to that. It just became don't do it. So I wrote a memo to my boss, who was sympathetic, saying this is wrong. I think this is wrong. So,
The deputy. Okay.
The political had gone.
Right.
The person who was, there might not have even been a political when I wrote to her. I don't think there was yet. It was at one of those gaps. So. And then on the power plant cases, the regulation was new source review. There had been and refineries, there had been a white paper published and online where EPA, the program office, had gone in to say, has new source review, and I'm shorthanding, but that's that anti-grandfathering. Has that interfered with energy? Has that somehow stunted growth? And they did a pretty deep analysis. There's no evidence of that. The industry's expanded.
Right.
In fact, they've expanded at a pretty rapid clip, which is why these cases come up. Because that's when you see the emissions increase. So then they took that offline. The new boss took it offline. I thought, uh-oh. The assistant administrator for air took it offline. And then the Cheney White House said, hold up. Don't go there. We're going to examine whether or not these cases are legally valid. We're going to ask the Justice Department to look at them. So we had settlements in hand. They walked away from the table, the industry, because they thought, okay, we don't have to do this.
Right, yeah, off the hook.
So that's when I left. But that was different. That was a rough period.
So
just to round it out so I don't forget it,
of course,
within about 3 years, because of, frankly, the war in Iraq, they had their hands full and their people at the White House were no longer looking at EPA, enforcement more or less got back on track. But we lost several years.
That type of tactic, right before a settlement takes place, where an executive power steps in and kind of delays it, have you ever seen that happen before?
And I felt like whatever you think of the law, we brought these cases, and of course, the Justice Department did find they were legally valid. Their political appointee found that, to his credit. But no, I've never seen it, and I thought when you're It's awkward because you work for the executive, but a decision, certainly once you file your cases, a decision to hold up for essentially political reasons, because the people that, you know, helped to pay for your campaign and stuff, you know, that felt Banana Republic to me. And plus we had settlements. Like, they had, in one case, they had signed, you know, the letter of agreement. Like, we're about to get, you know, 300,000 tons of air pollution reduced. They agreed to it. And they're smart people. They don't agree to things unless they, a combination of they think they have to and they think they can make it work. So, that really hurts.
Yeah. Alright. So, let's see. At this point, I think we're going to move into kind of the wrap-up questions.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit. Alright, so, kind of the answer to this one already, but how important would you say presidential transitions have been shaping your own work at the agency?
I'd say that they're important. I think certainly the, trying to figure out how to, I distinguish between, you know, transition is kind of, that means something short-term and specific. I think what you mean is the turnover from one White House to another, right?
Yeah.
Is that, I want to make sure I answer your questions. Yeah. A lot of memos written during transition that recommend this or that, they end up fading and getting lost. But the who holds power matters a whole lot to EPA in the 21st century in a way that it did not in the last century. I have to say, Reagan brought in a kind of wrecking crew in 1980 after he got elected. After about a year and a half, that was all undone.
Cheers, man.
Thanks. I would say important. I got it. It's
oh, really?
Important to do it.
Thank you. Really appreciate that.
Sure. It's just really important for an agency like EPA. EPA makes big decisions that affect some very powerful interest groups and makes them spend money, but they don't want to spend money.
Yeah.
Well, things they don't want to spend money on, and it is, you know, there a lot of decisions are controversial, so they're very much on the hot seat.
Mm-hmm.
If you're at the Department of Transportation, not so much. I mean, it can, you know, there's some impact, but EPA is right in the middle of a lot of controversial stuff.
Do you see what's currently going on with, you know, with the Trump administration? Do you see parallels, like obvious parallels with the Reagan administration?
Yes, in the sense that they make the kind of deregulation agenda bold and put it forward. Mm-hmm. I think Trump's much more, honestly, irrational just because he's freaking crazy. I mean, you can't, I think it's bad, but I also think it's going to be more chaotic. The Reagan administration had shrewd White House management.
Mm-hmm.
Partly, to be honest, because he knew, you know, Reagan himself was not going to be, let's say, a hands-on guy. You know, he liked to go to bed at 9 o'clock at night. And, you know, he was just not going to get neck deep in issues. And so they had tight management, very interested in protecting Reagan and his legacy and in focusing on the big issues like tax cuts, when the environmental rollback campaign they came in with became a political liability. They fired Watt, they fired Ann Burford, they put in very moderate managers, actually good managers at EPA, Bill Ruckelshaus. I don't know so much about Interior. And so they made that calculation. I don't see that with Trump. I think the White House is more, even more reckless than some of the people that are rumored for EPA. So I don't think there's going to be that check.
Yeah. Have you ever seen or heard of...
I should add, I'm sorry, the Republicans control the Hill. They did not under Reagan.
Right. Yeah. Have you ever seen an administrator or heard about an administrator that would you describe as similar to Scott Pruitt or something?
No, I cannot. I've never seen anybody that has as much of a zero. really a negative.
Yeah. Do you think that there might be, I mean, obviously it's a different Congress, Republican-controlled Congress. Do you see a potential for a backfire?
Yeah, I think he will get confirmed because Obama couldn't confirm anyone. They, as you know, they eliminated the filibuster for cabinet appointees. So they just need 51 votes to confirm him.
Yeah.
I think they'll get that. I think he, I'm hoping that there'll be at least 40 votes. Say no.
Yeah.
I think he'll be marked going in as controversial.
Mm-hmm.
I'm hoping that it, you know, that trouble develops and becomes visible. Obviously, if he doesn't do the bad things that we think we're pretty sure he's going to do, then great. You know, that'll be a good thing.
Yeah.
But if it plays out as we expect and the issues are raised now, they're marked now as he's going in,
mm-hmm.
it'll be easier to come back to. Thank you.
And honestly, just something I just haven't run across, but it probably has happened. It just happened faster. The current freeze on the EPA for grants, has that happened before? Is that...
I'm trying to remember. I can't... Remember, we've had shutdowns. There were a couple under Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
One under Obama. You know, and then that's a mess. So I'm trying to remember if there's been a freeze ordered at the executive level. I think I'm more used to freezes on, let's say, actual ceilings for grant expenditures or ceilings for hires than freezing. Thank you. That was great. Thanks.
Glad to hear it.
Freezing the mechanism in, you know, where you can't actually complete a grant.
Right.
That's a little unusual. I think that's got to be temporary because a lot of state programs shrivel up if you know the grants don't move.
Right.
So I'm assuming they plan eventually to release those, and they just wanted to get, you know, send a signal and get control up front.
Right. Finally, is there anything I haven't asked you about that you think I should know?
I don't think so. I mean, good questions. You've got... you're coming at this with having done homework, and obviously, I think it's structured in a way that you've covered the ground. If you assume I've covered your questions, you can always
Definitely.
Find me by email, so...
Yeah.
I sort of over-answer a little because, you know, I don't want to be just things that are somewhat complex to, you know, to something really simple.
Of course.
When they're not. So
yeah.
Apologize for some of the wordiness, but...
No. I mean, that's kind of the point and the nature of this form of interview. Is
yeah,
it supposed to be lengthy and wordy? It's not supposed to be reductionist. You know,
not,
we really want to be able to capture it.
It's not like AM radio and,
exactly.
you know, have 30 seconds to...
Yeah.
I've done that too, but...
Yeah.
Okay, good.
And you want a copy of these transcripts?
Yeah, sure. I mean, if it's not extra trouble, I don't want to put you to trouble, but...
It's not at all. I'm going to stop it now.